Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, dubbed the Hip Young Division of the Commonwealth Club, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. And you can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Laura Seidel. I'm a correspondent with National Public Radio. And joining us this evening is the very wonderful Alice Walker. She was the first black woman to ever win the Pulitzer Prize.
For fiction.
And she won the National Book Award. She's known for many accomplishments, among them the groundbreaking and controversial novels, to some people, The Color Purple, which was also turned into a Broadway musical, a movie, for her poetry, her civic activism within the civil rights movement in the South in the 60s, the Iraq War, and in support of women and children in conflict zones. Her first book of poetry was written when she was a senior at Sarah Lawrence College, and tonight she's here with us with another book of poetry, which actually is one of three books, I believe, you had come out this year in 1 year. That's prolific. That's a lot of stuff. You had The World Has Changed, Conversations with Alice Walker, Overcoming Speechlessness, A Poet Encounters the Horrors of Rwanda, East Congo, and Palestine, and now, most recently, Hard Times Require Furious Dancing. So let's start with the most recent book of poems, which I had the great pleasure of reading this week, and there are just some beautiful, beautiful moments in it. First, I just want to start with the title of it and why you called it Hard Times Require Furious Dancing.
Well, because if they didn't require furious dancing, they might encourage us to do other things that are not as much fun. And we might be prone to violence. We might be incredibly inclined to despair. And all of those things are useful, actually, to strengthen the psyche if you can get through the night. But at some point in my life, I realized that I would much prefer to honor the old tradition of dancing your sorrows into the ground rather than putting myself in the ground.
I can certainly get down with that. I think that's a good idea. You're the youngest of eight siblings, and in the course of writing this book, you lost one of your older sisters.
I lost one of my older sisters.
You know, and I was actually, which I was looking through some other interviews of yours, and way back you said, "All of my poems are written when I have successfully pulled myself out of numbing despair and stand again in the sunlight." Mm-hmm. And when I thought of that and the fact that you had lost a sister and you write about it in the poems, and I wondered if that was still true for you. Is this a book that came out of some dark times and you sort of emerged again into the sunlight?
To some degree, but I think it was in my earlier life that I wrote out of sadness. This is something that Langston Hughes said long ago about himself, that if he were never sad, he wouldn't write anything. And it was true for me that I used to write when I was very sad. But now I write whether I'm sad or happy. And in this instance, though, with my sister who died, what happened was that I was so afraid that I wouldn't have much feeling when she died. We'd had so many fights. But when she died, I was devastated. And I learned something, which is that we don't always know what we really feel about people until we lose them. And so I wrote this poem about her dying and my response and being many thousands of miles apart. And it was very helpful to me.
To actually just sit and get out those feelings. Well, it's a poem, actually, in this particular poem, I wonder if I should have you maybe. Would it be all right if I ask you to read a little?
Sure.
A little bit of the poem here. You know, you're sort of, she is far away, and that's clear in this, and yet you're remembering her in very beautiful ways and sending her feelings through the universe. And I guess in a way, maybe even that's healing, just to do that.
Well, I think I learned that we don't have to necessarily be next to people in order to be with them. And so I asked someone to help me with a ceremony far away for her. Word has reached me that you are dying. You who hid in the closet the morning I was born to witness my birth. Investigative Scorpio who did not believe in cabbage or stork. I am far away, not only in distance from your bed, but in emotion. Calling hospice, I hear your quite loud moans of resistance. You do not want to go, and even dying, you will not pretend otherwise. This is so my sister. Oprah you will miss. This is also my sister. Oprah you will miss, you have said, your most beloved, and all your friends from television who kept you company, befriending you through pain and drama over so many searing and tumultuous years. I, once so close, have drifted. And it goes on to talk about how lucky for me, I was in a different country, but a friend had come who is a priestess, and she led us through a ceremony that lasted quite a long time during this whole period of my sister's dying. And we chanted and we prayed and we lit incense and candles and we drummed a bit, hoping to send to my sister this feeling that she need not fear and that she was going to see our grandparents, who really, of all the people on earth, understood her. They loved her and they understood her. There's a real big difference. My parents loved her, but I don't think they understood her at all. But the grandparents, and this is one of the great things about grandparents, is that they can love and understand us and hold us. And so she was, I was reminding her, heading in that direction. She was heading toward those who love and understand her, and so there was no need to fear.
You know, I know recently you also were on stage with the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. And given the sort of chant you did in this, that made me also think about that recent appearance and the idea of art and does art come out of suffering. And that actually came up in your conversation with the Dalai Lama. I think Richard Gere was part of the conversation, and he talked about in the East that the practice of art was more about balance than it was about suffering. And I'm wondering, you have had a spiritual practice, and I believe some of it has been Buddhist. Do you think that has changed your relationship with creation and with art?
What I find is that Buddhism is so much like my Southern culture, Southern Black culture. In fact, when I was on stage last week, I guess it was, not long ago, with the Dalai Lama, part of what I was saying was how I hope that Buddhism will take root in the South because we need it, and that people like Milarepa, who did terrible things, you know, but then went through a period of transformation and became a saint, this is someone we know. This is our own history. This is our own story. And it's true that Buddhism is applicable to all of America because, you know, we are in dire straits. But for the South, it would be very good medicine. And so that's what I was talking about partly.
That's interesting. Milarepa is sort of a saint in Tibetan culture. Mm-hmm. They don't really have saints, but he's very important in Tibetan Buddhism. Yes, and he killed people, he did terrible things, and he's redeemed.
Yeah, and it reminded me of how, you know, when George Wallace, who was this really rabid racist person who really hated all black people and didn't want us to be educated at all and stood in the schoolhouse door and did all of that, you may remember him. But in any case, when he was shot and crippled, it was black people who came and prayed for him. And really, he ended up changing so much because he finally got it. You know, he finally got it that these people that he'd hated for so long, these were the people who had the heart to actually see him as a suffering fellow being. And they cared about him. It's remarkable.
That is remarkable.
So at the time now where religion, you know, most of the religions that we have been having are really wearing thin, I think that Buddhism, which I don't think of as a religion but more as a way of thinking and of growing, is very good medicine. And I think one of the reasons I like it is because the Buddha himself said, try it, and if it doesn't work, throw it out. Who else says that? You know? I mean, of all the others that only told us, you don't have to believe in the cross. You don't have to believe that somebody came back to life after they died. You know, it would have been a lot better for us, because I think if we are forced to believe things that are impossible, it makes us doubt our own integrity.
You have, for a long time, you were raised in, was it the Methodist tradition?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And for a long time, I guess you had said you did not believe in God, if I go back reading mm-hmm. what you had said previously. And I guess you still feel that way. It's not that you don't believe in God, but you do definitely bring a spirituality. It's infused throughout this book.
Which God are you talking about?
The white guy with the beard.
Why would
and
I
the,
believe
you know,
in him?
Yeah.
Is there one reason why I should believe in a God that looks like Charlton Heston? You know, even in South America, in Uxmal or somewhere in Mexico, in the middle of the night, they had us go to one of the temples there. These old temples, you know, the pyramids. And out of the pyramid comes the voice of Charlton Heston. He's not only our God, but he had somehow gotten down there and become their God. So he was, I am the God Shock. I am the rain God. No, thank you.
Yeah, maybe we could just get the Dalai Lama in a baseball cap. He likes to wear a baseball cap when he's under lights.
Yeah, but he's not trying to be a god, and he has a little cap, which I think is kind of cute. But I think that, you know, I don't call myself anything more than, you know, the sort of the pagan that I am. I love nature. I find my inspiration there. I always have since I was a child. I stopped going to church regularly when I was, 11 or 13. And by then, my parents were so tired because they had raised 8 children, and they were very poor, and they had struggled very hard, and, you know, they'd seen, you know how we feel about the election now? They've seen election days that would make this one just seem so much fun, you know? So after all of that with them, they really couldn't be as attentive to my the nature that loved the earth. They couldn't say, well, no, you have to come in here and be in church. They had to leave me alone. And that was great because I learned my freedom there.
It seems like nature remains for you something that's very important. It's in the poetry. It's in so many of your words. Flowers, also animals, which again, I think you lost a dog, I think, in the process.
My dog Marley.
Yeah, and that also comes up in this. You felt a very strong connection as well to animals.
Well, I think that animals have never done us any harm, and that we, as a species, we have just ravaged them and destroyed so many of them, and so many of them are extinct. And I don't think humanity is worth what we've done to them. And so I'm all for them being able to live and to come back if they can. And that, you know, there's a joke that was a cartoon that I learned from Jack Kornfield, who is one of my teachers. These hunters were looking at the deer, and the deer were looking at the hunters, and the deer were saying to each other, why don't they thin their own damn herds? and this is what I agree with the deer. Why don't we thin our own damn herds? Because there are too many humans, and we are taking over more and more of the habitat of everything and destroying the planet in the process. And I don't see that we can say that we're worth it. You know, I think that if you're going to kill all the whales and all of the birds and all of the animals, you know, I don't see that that's something that says that you are very high in the ranks of species, you know? I mean, I would say the orangutan, for instance, is endangered. They are down to very few. And one of the characteristics of the orangutan is that if you give an orangutan anything, they will take only half of it and give you the other half back.
Really? That's fascinating. That's amazing. If only we could learn to be more like them, I think we'd be in pretty good shape.
Well, and what happens when you lose them is that is the teaching that you lose. That's one of the reasons that we have to save animals, because they all teach us something very special, and this is something that indigenous people have tried to tell us, and native people have tried to tell us, that they are teachers. They are really hardcore, important, necessary instructors of how to live on this planet. But we haven't paid attention.
You, I think, in so much of your work, I think there is... There's a politics about struggling to live on the planet, struggling to be... politics has always been a part of your work, and I think it remains so. It's interesting. I was reading, and I actually didn't know this. I'm a big fan of the Russian authors. And when you were younger, you read a lot of the Russian authors. And the Russian writers always have incorporated politics into what they do. But often, I think writers and artists are afraid to do that. It's a struggle, I think, to do it. And you have managed to talk about things and subjects without becoming propaganda. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. How, as a person who is political, do you take on things and still turn it into art and not get, you know, what is it in you that's been able to do that without getting stuck in becoming propaganda?
I'm an artist.
Indeed, but some people stuck there. You know what I mean?
But yeah, they get stuck there because they're not. I think the difference is that if you just have an agenda and you're trying to put forth an issue that you want people to accept, then you do the propagandistic, you know, thing, whatever that is for you. But an artist comes from the heart, and they understand that unless you move the heart, any change that you accomplish is temporary, because the people have not been changed fundamentally. You know, they will go this way for a year and that way another year. But when you actually reach the heart, you have someone who is dedicated to a way of being, and they understand that it's about them. It's not about an agenda at all. It's about them, and it's life and death, what you understand about reality and what you understand about truth and how you're willing to, you know, appear. I mean, that is to say, stand or something in the world.
I mean, in this recent book, you take on, there's one poem where you talk about the stoning of a woman, and I was that based on a particular instance that you had seen? It sounded as if it was.
Well, this was a stoning that I saw in a film, but recently, you know, there's the Ashtiani stoning to be, or the situation in Iran, I'm sure everybody here is aware of it, where this woman was lashed 99 times in front of her children, and they've been threatening her with stoning, and this is a custom, you know, in some parts of the world. And I wrote that poem because I wanted whoever is out there who is subjected to even the fear of stoning, I wanted them to know that we know about it. We know it's happening. This is one of the things I love about the time that we live in, that you can always find a way to let people in the world know that you know. And sometimes just knowing that someone knows is so sustaining. And I know that because when we were in Georgia in the 60s and Mississippi, in those places where it was really very frightening, it meant a lot to us that people from outside came to be with us, or they wrote to us, or they telephoned. So that is what that poem is saying. And I posted it on my website and dedicated it to this present woman's children, because they have been begging the planet. They've been begging us to save their mother. And we should be able to save their mother. Why can't we save their mother? All the smart people on this planet, surely we can save their mother. So it's an appeal, you know, what can you do? This is for everybody to think about. I mean, are we going to sit, you know, far away and just say, well, these people, this is how they are, they stone people? No, I don't think so. You know, I don't know if you've seen these photographs of African Americans who were flogged, you know, 99 times, 100 times. And what you see when that heals is just that your back is just a mass of welts. So it's very real for me. It's very real, and there's no way of not addressing this in whatever way I can.
Yeah, I mean, in one of the books you had come out this year, you had Overcoming Speechlessness.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems related to this. You went to situations, clearly, where people don't often talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's definitely a theme in your work of, indeed, bearing witness.
Mm. Sometimes it's all you can do. It's all you can do. You hear about something horrible, some atrocity somewhere, and you can't believe people are actually doing it. You know, this WikiLeaks thing is so amazing. I mean, they've been so quiet in the media about that, but it is shocking to realize some of the things that our people have been doing to people. Some of the techniques of torture, you know, some of this outright murder, you know, everywhere. You know, just killing people for basically because they're there. And you wonder, you think, well, what can I do? But you can witness it, and you can not pretend, you know, that it's not happening and that you don't know about it. And you can have a circle, and you can discuss it with your friends. You can talk about it with your children so that they are not given this information in a way that is incredibly, horribly disfiguring of their psyches. Because they have an idea, most of our children, I think, have an idea about what Americans are like, what we're like. And now we find out that this other side, which actually many people in the South saw for generations, this other side is now blooming in all of its frightening scariness. And so it's very good to witness these things so that you're not taken by surprise. You don't think that people are something that they're not. America has a long history of being a very repressive and scary place for many, many people. And we're all about to see a lot more of that. And it's nice to really prepare by looking at your country and looking at the rest of the world and looking at the human psyche in its disfigurement.
You know, I was thinking before this interview, too, about your life and what an incredible journey it's been from being the daughter of sharecroppers in the South and the civil rights movement, traveling the world and seeing the various things that you see. And you were a writer, a black woman writer, at a time when really, you know, it was much harder perhaps even than it is now. I guess the question I would ask, looking at the landscape, we have an African-American president. You won a Pulitzer. Toni Morrison won a Nobel. Do you think that really is a sign of lasting progress, or are you looking at the landscape right now, some of the backlash we're seeing? I think we saw a certain amount of racism towards the president. Do you feel it's easier now if you're an African-American woman writer, a young writer coming up?
I have such joy in what I do that, in a way, I don't care what they're doing. I know what I'm doing. And it fills me with delight that I can tell these stories and I can connect with people all over the planet. There will be a backlash. You know, I was reading somewhere recently that Booker T. Washington was asked to tea with Franklin Roosevelt. Or was it Theodore? I think it was Theodore, the first one. And he went to tea with the president, and the racists basically were so upset that they made him really decide never to do that again. And it was 30 years before another black person was invited inside the White House for tea. 30 years. So we are dealing with a great deal of vindictiveness and, you know, savage racism. But on the other hand, I actually think it's better to see it than not to see it, to know it rather than to assume that people have changed when they haven't. So to me, I think it is very much, you know, reality. I mean, the capitalism as a system is not good for most of the people, and people will eventually see that. I think, you know, many of us think that we'll be fine because we'll get a little store or something and, you know, make a lot of money. But mostly, I think if it is a system that rapes the world, takes all the resources from everybody, and gives back very little, and wants to control, and the money, as we see, is ending up in the hands of basically very wealthy white people. And they have their cohorts like Clarence Thomas, you know, and Condoleezza, and, you know, people like that. And I think that what we learn is that if you want to be led in a good direction, learn to lead yourself. And that's where I feel that many people fall down, because they don't know how. They don't have a practice. They say they don't have time. They feel like they have to take somebody else's direction. But actually, you can learn to lead yourself. You have an internal compass, and it's your conscience. And if you live, you know, according to your conscience, you will find the right way. And it won't be all about depending on people who are in office to lead you. I mean, you can lead yourself.
I think we have a room full of future people who will be leading themselves after that comment.
Well, they're probably already leading themselves. They have that look.
Yeah. Right here to you, to hear you speak. You wrote a letter to President Obama when he was first elected. And in it, you know, there was something I was going back. I had remembered that, and I went back and looked at it. And you wrote to him, make a schedule that permits sufficient time to rest and play with your gorgeous wife and lovely daughters. And we are used to seeing men in the White House soon become juiceless and as white-haired as the building. And, of course, I looked at the picture on the cover of the New York Times today of the president looking very tense, and I have indeed noticed his hair getting whiter. Mm-hmm. And whiter. And I thought about that letter, and I thought, I wonder what you would say to him now. We're 2 years into it. It's into his presidency. It has certainly not been an easy 2 years.
Well, I would say to him, be bold. Do everything that it is within your power to do while you have the power. Because all of this... all of this that we see is about taking the power away from him. That's what it's about. I mean, I've seen this. This is the South all over again. They can't stand it that he's a black man, he's intelligent, and he's cute. So they're having a problem. But we've seen this before. It's not new. I think it might be new to him. I think he really would have benefited from living in Mississippi for 2 or 3 years. And living in Georgia, and living in Alabama, and living in Louisiana, he would have learned something about who he's up against. Because they don't really care about the country. It's only about winning. It's only about fighting. It's only about making him look terrible. You know? And that's all it's about, really. And if people really think that they're going to get in office and actually make improvements and help them, they are crazy. Because they will get in there and they will do what they've always done, which is try to make everybody else look terrible and make themselves look good, and they'll end up with all the money. You just watch. That's what will happen.
Well, I guess a lot of people have tried to tell him to be bold, and we'll see what happens now the next couple of years in his presidency.
Well, I think that he had a very wonderful mother, and she was white, and he had these grandparents who were white, and they loved him. And I think he got confused. And so I think that there's a way in which he is so good. He's such a good guy, and I really love him. I love the Obamas and the dog, the cat, you know, everybody. But I think that he's up against people who really don't care about goodness. They don't know what goodness is. And when they see goodness, it's almost like a, you know, something that they go like this. Because it is something that is not, generally speaking, taught to the kind of people that we're seeing rising. Goodness is not something that is part of what they are taught as children. You can look at them and see that what they're taught as children is that you have to take what you want, you have to get ahead, you know, you have to look a certain way, you have to at least pretend to some kind of superiority in order to feel that you're justified as a human being. So, you know, we're in for it, but what is also true in this situation is that many people didn't vote. Now, I'm as radical as anyone, and I, you know, have my thoughts about how to change things, but I also vote. I think if you can't at least vote, it's very difficult for us to get anywhere.
You know, that's always been a problem in this country, mm-hmm. and it must be amazing you fought for the right for people to be able to get to vote back in the 60s in the South, so it must be sort of sad, actually, to see so many people not vote.
Well, one of the problems with my sister, one of the reasons we had our little differences, was that, you know, all the years that I was in Mississippi and really in danger, you know, trying to help people register to vote and, you know, people following our car and shooting and, you know, I mean, and so years go by and I'm talking to her about some voting, I think for Barack Obama. And then she tells me, well, I never vote. And why does she never vote? Because she is a Jehovah's Witness, and they don't vote. So I have to say I was hurt.
And this was the sister who just passed away, mm-hmm. and that was part of the...
Yes, because I felt that she was close enough to me. In fact, she had come to visit me in Mississippi, even though she said at one point, she said, you know, when you went to live there, I said to whoever, Mississippi is so dangerous that I will never even fly over it. But she did come to visit, you know. So it wasn't that she was unaware. It's just that somehow it had never occurred to her that her sister was risking her life so that she could vote. But she was listening to a patriarchal religion that said she didn't have to vote and she would, you know, she wouldn't. It was very difficult to accept.
You have still other siblings who are alive, right?
Two.
Mm-hmm. Are you close to them?
Well, they live in Georgia and I live here and mm-hmm. I rarely go back to Georgia.
Yeah.
So it's okay, but it's not very close. And they're my elder siblings. So basically because of the economic situation in Georgia when they were young, they had to leave Georgia in order to find a place in the world. And that was one of the reasons I was in the movement, so that I could make it possible for people like them to stay if they wanted to.
And they did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's
good. They left, but then they came back because it was safe for them. It's safe for them now to be in Georgia.
It's a very different place from mm-hmm. what it was then. You know, I was thinking, I do a lot of coverage of a lot of the new media and new technology, and I noticed you have a blog, mm-hmm. and there are YouTube videos, and I think of you as a very thoughtful person, a very thoughtful writer, and I'm looking at all this new media, And you were talking about how it's possible to bear witness with it, and all of that's great. But I also wonder, do you feel some sense right now that there's extraordinary pressure on even you as a writer now from all these different places, from YouTube, from Twitter, to keep a blog, to do this? Do you feel any sense that it gets at all harder right now at this moment in time to create the space to be an artist?
No. I find that my challenge is to not do so much. And so I periodically wear myself out, and then I think I'm done. And I announce to all my friends, I'm done. I don't have to do anything more. And then I go off somewhere, and I rest. I lie in the hammock. I plant collard greens. I play with my dog. And before I know it, some new creation has announced itself, and I'm into it and loving it. So I don't respond very much to pressure from outside. Mm-hmm. I have all of my internal pressure and my direction from wherever, you know, ancestors or, you know, just love. I mean, sometimes the love that I feel for people will propel me into a situation, you know, so that I can do what I can. You know, I have my tool, which is my pen or my laptop.
I wonder, too, with all of this going on, what is the role? I mean, Steve Jobs somewhat famously said in the last couple years, you know, oh, books are over. I think there is, you know, it's harder and harder, I think, in some ways, to be a writer, to make a living as a writer, to sell books. And the thing about writing is that it really does make you think, and that's part of the beauty of it. So does reading, and reading a novel, and that process. What is the role right now, do you think, of being a writer in our society at a moment like this, when there are so many pressures actually that pull you away from sitting quietly with a book and reading?
Well, I think it's up to each of us. It depends on how much you want to be in touch with your own inner self and with the world. And actually, if people decide to give up that moment, that, you know, 5 hours, let's say, of being stretched, that 5 hours of growing with a wonderful novel, like, for instance, I don't know, something by Dostoevsky or, you know, Faulkner or Virginia Woolf, if you want to give that up, then we just have to accept that we are turning into different beings, you know? And I think when we see people more and more glued to various gadgets that are short, you know, things are short, and their attention span is gone, you realize that we are. Humans are turning into something very different, and that maybe you, well, I don't know about you, but I probably won't go there. You know, I will probably prefer to use the last part of my life savoring wonderful novels and wonderful poetry. I read Rumi almost every night. And I so love it. I mean, the rest of the world can decide that they don't care about poetry or they don't have time for poetry. But that is entirely their affair. Because for me, the beauty of literature is its amazing ability to just make us grow and expand and understand and cure our fearfulness often. Because we get to see inside other people, and we get to see, you know, what's the real deal about humanity? You know, who are we? Who are we? And the other thing about literature that I wish we could have for our young people is this way of seeing why things happen, like, you know, where we are now in the election, and this whole period, you know, with Obama. If we had people, young people, and slightly older people who were well-read, none of this would be mysterious at all. I mean, you would just know all these people. You know, they're like, you know, oh, that's so-and-so, and that's so-and-so, and that's so-and-so. And it's really wonderful in that way. And I do regret that people have decided, under a lot of pressure, you know, a lot of the capitalist pressure to sell things, that they don't have time to deepen or widen, really, either.
One good thing is Rumi is, I think, wildly popular mm-hmm. at this moment, and that's a great thing. I'm wondering, who are you reading right now in the, you know, contemporary writers? Who do you think right now is of interest to you?
Well, I can never remember when people ask me this question. I do know that the last two novels that I truly adored were, one was by an Iranian woman who actually lives in San Francisco, and her novel is called The Blood of Flowers, and it's about an Iranian, actually a Persian young woman in the 7th century. Yeah, I think, or the 17th century. Anyway, long time ago. Excuse me. Who is a carpet maker. And in this novel, you get to learn all kinds of things. That's the other thing about novels. I learned more about beautiful carpets from reading this. I love carpets. And I learned so much about them in this novel. And a lot about the culture and how Persia, which later became Iran, morphed into Iran. So it's a crucial novel, because you have all of this beauty, all of the artistic information about carpet making, but you also have a real cultural teaching about what is the foundation of Iran. And we need to know this. We need to know this, because if our country is going to support Israel in bombing Iran, I want us to know how many carpet makers we're going to be hitting and how many rugs we're going to be destroying. I want us to know this. And then the other novel was I think her name is Kari Desai, but she's an Indian writer. And her novel is just absolutely amazing, but I can't think of what the name of it is. If it comes to me, I'll tell you.
I've heard her name. I haven't read anything by her, but I know.
I think it's The Inheritance of Loss. The Inheritance of Loss, and it will tell you more than you have ever dreamed of knowing about Indian immigrants coming to this country from India and what that trail is like. It is absolutely harrowing, exquisitely written, and will just keep you glued to it. And the good part is that both of these are on audiobooks, so you can listen. And they, you know, sometimes on audiobooks they have readers who are just dreadful. And they have no idea what they're reading, and they have no feeling about the story. But this, in these two cases, they have excellent readers.
Well, that's good to know. Something to look forward to when you're driving in the car. Just in a few minutes, we're going to go to questions from you all for Alice. So just you can start thinking about that now. Are you working on another novel? What are you working on?
I never talk about what I'm working on.
Oh. I asked the forbidden question. Well,
that's okay.
You know,
it's all right.
I'm sort of curious. You know, you've gone back and forth from nonfiction to poetry to fiction.
I can tell you what I just finished, though.
Okay.
The Chicken Chronicles. They'll be published next year.
The Chicken Chronicles.
Yes.
What are the Chicken Chronicles?
Well, I'll be as short as I can be with this. When I was 40, I decided that I wanted to do two things. I wanted to go to Bali, and I wanted to sing The Sweet Honey in the Rock. So I did both of them. I went to Bali, and when I was in Bali, I was coming home one day from a fire dance, and there was a chicken that came by with its little babies, and I was completely mesmerized, and I couldn't figure out why. I just couldn't, you know, it was just like I'd never seen a chicken. So 20 years later, many thoughts about chickens, I decided I have to have some chickens to raise, so I have chickens. I raise chickens. And what has happened is that the chicken is like the Madeleine cookie of Proust. They took me completely back to parts of my childhood. So the Chicken Chronicles is a memoir about having an interactive life with chickens when I was little.
That's great. I mean, it's you know, one thing I did forget to mention, too, that there is also a lot of there is humor in this, too. I think there's sort of an ode to your old BMW or your old Beamer in here.
Yeah, I have an almost 17-year-old car, which I just, You know, I people have the Prius, and I'm so happy for you. But for some reason, I cannot imagine not having my old Beamer. And so this poem is about, you know, loving the wabi-sabi of life. You know, the things that are a little tattered, a little battered, but with so much heart and so much soul. And so that's, yes.
Yeah, no, I there are moments in here of great humor and something that actually has always been in your work. I mean, when somehow, and in fact, not to forget the name of it, Hard Times Require Furious Dancing, you are obviously a woman who also knows how to have a good time.
I do.
In all of this, you know, darkness, we do have to make time to dance. I guess we have to make time for questions, too. So I want to open the floor for questions. Right here.
Hi, my name's Amanda.
Oh, I should say, I think you need to wander over here to the microphone. Maybe people should line up, perhaps, if you have questions behind the mic.
Hello. My name is Amanda, and I read and saw the movie Color Purple 20 years ago, and it set the course of my life direction for the duration of my adolescence, teenage, and adulthood. So thank you. And for that, the love of literature began and evolved. And I was just wondering, have you ever had that experience with any book in a similar time period in your life?
That it really changed me and transformed me.
And you developed who you were.
I think Jane Eyre. When I was 13, I discovered Jane Eyre. And I read Jane Eyre, you know, every year for the next 20 years. And I love Thomas Hardy novels, but I think Jane Eyre actually was that book for me. Just a wonderful novel. And just the thought that young people won't read Jane Eyre, you know, it's really sad. Yeah.
Love Jane Eyre. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Another question here.
Hi, Ms. Walker. Thank you so much for your marvelous body of work and your humanity, especially your compassion and recognition of the lives of political prisoners and prisoners of war. I hosted a radio show this afternoon celebrating the life of Marilyn Buck, who was released July this year after 33 years behind bars, and then she died in August of the same year, just a month later. Yuri Koshiyama, Safiya Elijah, Linda Evans, and Miranda Bergman spoke about Marilyn's life and shared poetry. And there is actually a celebration of her life this Sunday in Oakland. But my question is, can you speak to your commitment and compassion, particularly your remembrance of those brothers and sisters who are behind bars?
Well, the person who comes right to mind is Mumia. I went to visit, excuse me, I went to visit Mumia twice, and each time I realized that this is a person who is so magnificent and such a huge heart. And it was very hard to leave. You know, I could almost not leave, but of course, you know, they would make me leave. This being who is in a tiny cell for 22 hours a day, and yet who manages, I mean, he's such a teacher. He manages to show us what you can do even when they've taken away everything. They even took away most of his books and most of his writing materials. And he still manages to be on top of almost everything that's going on in the world. And he has a commentary that comes every week that really, and he will have a wonderful thing to say about what just happened, and it'll be very incisive. So I think of him as a really good teacher for us, and he shows us that there's no need to feel that there's nothing you can do because, you know, you don't have this and you don't have that. I mean, he does what he does without any freedom except the freedom of his being.
You actually, did you go visit Aung San Suu Kyi?
I went to Burma.
Yeah, you did. Did you actually visit her?
No, because this is Myanmar, Burma, a year before, to actually just stand, in fact, not even stand because they would arrest you, The people in Burma can't even say her name. But I love Aung San Suu Kyi, and I think of all the leaders in the world, she's the one that I would more readily be willing to be behind, because she has the greatest clarity of thought, not just about morality and, you know, Buddhist principles. She's a devout Buddhist. But she also, you know, just has a wisdom that comes, I think, from a lot of discipline, a lot of understanding of what the people need, a lot of love of the people, and the people return that love. It's such a beautiful thing in Burma. The junta is very repressive, and they recently, as you know, put her back in house arrest after they had put her in the prison. And, you know, they just, I don't know how she bears it, but she does. And there's a book of hers called something about hope. I can't remember the full title, but I really recommend it, because you will see some of the finest thinking about what democracy, which we don't have, you know, about what democracy really is and what it can be. This woman who, again, like Mumia, is locked down in her house, can't leave.
Yeah, for those, I mean, she won the Nobel Peace Prize, and has been this imprisoned leader in Burma for some time. Are there other questions here? Right here? Just step up to the microphone.
Hi, Ms. Walker. Thank you so much. I'm Jen, and I have a question for you about food. So in my mind, I see you as this revolutionary of great passion. Everything that you do, your sword and shield is love and words, and everything that comes out of you comes purely from your heart space. And even in what you've said tonight, you said, I have such joy for what I do. And then I loved the, if you want to lead, lead in a good direction, learn to lead yourself. Mm-hmm. And as I've combed through some of your interviews and things that you love, what keeps popping up for me with the food that you love is teas and collard greens and dark leafy greens, which are all bitter foods. And I'm wondering if there was a food that fueled your passion, what would it be, and what does that food mean to you? If there was a food, like if you have a favorite food, if there was a food that fueled your passion and your heart space fire for what you do, what would it be, or what does that food mean?
It would be the collard green.
It would be the collard green.
Oh, yeah, no.
Okay.
Hands down. No, I think there's a lot to be said for people sticking to the food that has brought them through, you know, as a people. And the collard green has brought us through. And it accounts basically for our strong bones. African Americans generally, well, until they started going to McDonald's, they had very strong bones and very good skin. And these are things, and strong teeth. And these are things that you really get from the collard green. And I have learned to plant it, you know, wherever I am. I have collard greens growing, you know, that's how you know where I live. And I eat them. And the thing that I learned recently, though, in the last couple of years, is that I can eat them raw in smoothies. So you just take your collard greens and put them in the Vitamix, and you put in some apples and a banana and, you know, whatever else you want to put in. But that's really enough. And that will carry you a very long time.
Is there a recipe book in the works?
Well, I just gave you the recipe.
That was it. Just one.
The main thing is, just have the greens. And then whatever else you have, you know, you can put oranges, you can have bananas, you can have figs. The figs just started. You know, we thought the figs had been frozen out. And because they were all like this. And then just in the last week or so, they plumped out. You know how figs do on the tree? So we've been picking figs and eating a lot of figs in smoothies with collard greens. And turns out this is really tasty.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Had another question here.
Mm-hmm.
Beloved Mother Alice, I adore you. It's so wonderful. So wonderful to sit in your presence. to share that song with you. And all my brothers and sisters here, thank you so much. It's been an awesome experience. My question is this, that within the immense despair of the depth of what we're facing as a world community, what is the very deepest fountain of your hope and your inspiration? Where do you, what do you draw as being the source of your very deepest hope and inspiration?
What is my own source of my deepest inspiration? The earth. The earth has my complete loyalty and my complete adoration and my respect in every single moment. And it seems to me that as long as it continues to be faithful to us, which is to say it goes through its changes and it manages to produce enough sustenance for us, then we can return this. We can learn, if we've forgotten, how to return this love that the earth gives us. I can't even imagine trying to live without that feeling of connection to the seasons, for instance. You know, my sense of time in nature, how it changes and what it produces. So, yes, that's my fuel.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have another question here. Just wander up to the microphone and feel at peace there.
Hello. My question, going back to the ill will toward the president by many parts of people in parts of our country, my question is your thoughts on language and racism right now. It seems that, and even John Stewart said in his speech at his rally last week about what, you know, what warrants being called a racist now. Like, you can use racist language but say that you're not a racist, especially in our media you see this. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on where language has taken the racism in America right now.
You know, that's a very good question, because the more I've thought about this issue of racism and the word racism and racist, and, you know, excuse me, what has been very clear to me is that actually the label racism and racist is a mask for envy, and that it helps people to have a label when they envy other people. It helps them then to have a label that they can use to put on the other person, to make it seem like it's their fault that they are not liked. So you know, you then find that somebody's color is a problem for you. But actually, what you really feel is that, how did they get that gorgeous? You know, how dare they be like that? But if you can get an ideology going, which makes however they are a problem, and you give it a name, and you put it in place, then you can basically reduce them. You make them smaller, you make them weaker, you make them something, you know, so that you look bigger and you look more terrific. So I think that it's useful when we look at people who are acting in what we consider racist ways. It's useful to look to see what they are hiding, you know, what it is about them that would make them have to, I think they have to, treat other people in a derogatory way.
You know, I wondered actually on the issue of language and racism, and you were talking earlier about, well, in some ways it's better if it's out there. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if actually at this moment, though, it's less out there. Everybody's sort of afraid to say, well, you know, they don't like Obama. It has nothing to do with his race. It's just I don't like him. You know, it actually may be more cloaked than it used to be in some ways.
But everybody knows it. You know, why are we pretending? You know, I mean, it's this country has always been racist, and it's always had a foundation in envy. When the people came here from Europe in 1492, they discovered all these indigenous people who were just fine. You know, they were generous, they were beautiful, they made great art, they could dance. And they were very, you know, giving, so that, you know, the Columbus wrote back about, you know, they're just, you know, they're so sweet, these people. And you know, so he basically right away thought that they were such good people that he would just enslave them and kill them and take some of them back to, you know, Europe. And you know, they would kill as many as 3,000 Native people a day, you know, in by all kinds of horrible means. That's why when we look at the torture that is happening in the world, you know, some of our people are doing this. This is a long history of this. We have a long history of that behavior, and we have to really acknowledge it. It's not going to kill us to really look at our history of what happened when the colonizers came here, what they did to the indigenous people. There is a karmic debt that this country will have to pay. It's not something that, you know, I'm saying it has to do. It's just in the, you know, cause and effect. If you actually do the things that have been done to people, you know, in this country, there is a price. And I think in some ways Obama, you know, was an effort to try to change it before it can be changed. And so I've often said that actually he was probably too good a person to try to do that. It's like he's trying to, and they're demanding that he do in 2 years what it took 500 years to put in place. 500. You know, and also this, the system is really imperfect, because it does not make any sense at all to think that you can do very much in 2 years, anybody. I mean, it takes me 2 years to write a novel. But to think that you can do so many things in 2 years and then in the middle of everything you have to drop what you're doing and go out and campaign, that's idiotic. What kind of sense does that make? Whose idea was that? It's a bad idea. And then, you know, instead of, now, meanwhile, the world is in flames. You notice the planet is in flames. It is going up in flames. And they're talking about, you know, who's going to be running in the next election, who's going to be doing this, and who's going to get that. It's really, it's pathetic, and it's shameful. It really is.
We have time for one more question, and please.
I'm honored to be here. My name is Elizabeth, and my question, I'm originally born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee, and my question is, what advice would you give me? I've been in California since 1984, and I haven't been back to Memphis since 2000, and the last time I was there, it was so engulfed in memories of pain. Mm-hmm. And so what advice would you give me to embrace, because I'm getting ready to go back in about 6 months, to embrace some love that I only can remember the pain. So what?
Well, it has helped me when I go back to Georgia to find my tribe. I have a tribe in Georgia. And they're not the people I grew up with, actually, but they are in Georgia. Well, actually, one of them I went to school with. But this is very helpful. Try to find the people who are your people. And you can have your tribe anywhere. So I thought at one point that I might move back to Georgia, but it doesn't seem likely, because there was so much pain. And I did spend 7 years in Mississippi, and that took care of all the South I think I need. But I go there, I go back to Atlanta, and it's wonderful to be with my people, the people that I love and the people who understand you know, what I'm about, and I honor them for what they're about.
Thank you.
Well, Alice Walker, this has been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
To have this time with you. I have to officially bring the meeting to a close with that wonderful reception for you. I want to quote, if I may, you here, which I just thought these lines were particularly beautiful to me. You wrote, "This we know, we were not meant to suffer so much and to learn nothing." And I just thought that was particularly thoughtful and beautiful. So, again, thanks for that applause. And now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.